This is Biblical Wisdom, an online Bible study with Dr. John Collins.
What I have planned to excite you all this evening is the Book of Koheleth, or Ecclesiastes. Now, this is the book that, one of the books that had a really hard time getting into the canon. You know, this was one of the books that the rabbis argued over. Should this really be in here? And in the end of the day, they decided that it should, and I think that was one of their better decisions. There were a couple of others that I might have argued with, but we'll leave that. The Hebrew name of the book is Koheleth, and that is a puzzle. The Hebrew word kahal is well known, Q-A-H-A-L. That means congregation. But Koheleth is a feminine participle. And why, you know, this isn't purporting to be the speech of a woman. Why a feminine participle? The Greek name Ecclesiastes, which then got passed on into Latin and English, means kind of like church person or assembly person. Something like that. That's an attempt to make sense of the Hebrew. Sometimes it's called the preacher, which is just a shot in the dark. I don't think this man was a preacher at all. This wasn't his mode of operation. So that one really is a puzzle, and I don't really have an answer to it as to why the book should be called Koheleth. Some people would say that's the least of the puzzles that the book presents you with. It starts out by saying, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Now, in Jewish tradition, the thought was that this book was written by Solomon in his old age. Now, there may be signs of old age in this book, but it most certainly was not written by Solomon. Now, how do we know that? Well, because there are Persian loan words in the book. Now, there had been no contact with Persians in the time of Solomon. That didn't have, Solomon lived, you know, about 950 BCE, presumably. The Persians only became a factor, you know, only came in contact with the Jews about 550 or a little bit later. And so that the book of Koheleth, I'm pretty sure, is later than that. There are some other indications in it too. I think most likely it was written in the Hellenistic period. Now, some people have tried to detect philosophical influences in it, perhaps Epicurus. But also a lot of it can be explained as just kind of common ancient Near Eastern wisdom. Vanity of vanities, says Koheleth, vanity of vanities, and all is vanity. And in case you missed that in the first verse, he'll repeat it regularly as you go through the book. Now, what does vanity here mean? The Hebrew word is haval, haval havalim, hevel, which means transient stuff. Vapor is the word that comes to mind. Now, you know, like the a mist, the dew in the morning, something that's there but then blows away, that doesn't really have solid substance that you can lay hold of. And that, in a nutshell, is Koheleth's perception of life. Now, forgive me for intruding my personal perspective on this. I find this book quite refreshing. Most books in the Bible kind of overcompensate with meaning. And a lot of religious people kind of overcompensate with meaning, you know, finding richness of meaning where there mightn't be so much. Now, Koheleth won't have any of that. He's a minimalist. You know, he wants to know, what do we really know? And, you know, that which you don't know, you shouldn't talk about. And so it tends to be a rather minimal book that way. So that's one keynote that he hits you with right at the beginning. And next one, in the next verse, is, what do people gain from all the toil at which they toil under the sun? Now, this is sometimes cited actually as evidence of the Hellenistic date of the book. And why should that be? Because you had by then a growth of commerce. You know, the purpose of business is to make a profit. According to Koheleth, what profit is there in the end of the day? And you see that the bottom line for him really is that whatever profit you think you have made all gets wiped away in the end. You can't take it with you. And for that reason, says Koheleth, there is no profit. No matter what you may think you have acquired, whether it be money or wisdom or whatever, poof, it all blows away in the end. And therefore, the idea that we're achieving something in life is an illusion. A generation goes, a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. Now, some of you may have been under the impression that the Bible taught that the world comes to an end. Well, of course, the Bible does teach that the world comes to an end. The Bible teaches many contradictory things. But the strand of the Bible that teaches that this world comes to an end is quite different from this. And actually, Koheleth was much more typical of thought in ancient Israel and Judaism. Even in the time of Christ, there was a philosopher in Alexandria, a Jewish philosopher named Philo. And we'll hear more of Philo later on when we get to the wisdom of Solomon. But now, Philo said, why would God destroy anything so perfect as this world, as the cosmos? You know, granted, God could destroy it if he wanted to, but what sense would that make? Why would he want to? So the idea that this world comes to an end is actually the exception rather than the rule. But for most people in the ancient world, it's like this. The sun rises, the sun goes down, it hurries to the place where it rises, and the sun is up there, you know, going across the sky, and then it has to sprint like hell to get back to the east by the morning to do it all over again. And in the biblical worldview, of course, it's the sun going around the earth, not the earth going around the sun. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. All things are wearisome, more than one can express. For what has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. Now, that, I would say, is a most un-American idea. You know, it's almost offensive to modern Western people. Because, you know, we live for novelty. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has already been said in the ages before us. I can testify to that from the field of biblical scholarship. Every year there are books and articles published saying, behold, this is new. But if they had just done their homework, they would know that somebody had said it 50 or 70 years ago. But as Koheleth said, people of long ago are not remembered. Now, and again, this has only gotten worse with time. And there is, I don't know that there has ever been a civilization as contemptuous of history as ours, as contemporary American culture. you know, something that history, Henry Ford famously said, history is bunk. You don't bother with that. History is the nightmare that we're trying to awaken from, as James Joyce put it. But, well, be that as it may, it does often leave us rather, you know, with a mistaken idea of the novelty of the ideas that we're coming up with, when in fact, that, you know, they're most of these things have been around if you knew enough to know that. People of long ago are not remembered, nor will there be any remembrance of people yet to come. You know, it's not even people long ago. Believe me, when you retire, you discover this very fast. Of people who are gone, there is no memory. Students who come in a year after you retire don't know you ever existed. And it's a humbling thought, but this is the way it is. You think there have been an awful lot of people who were famous in their time that absolutely nobody now remembers. So this is the perspective of Koheleth. When King over Israel, he says, I applied my mind to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. Now, as I mentioned in the opening lecture, you know, all wisdom claims to be based on observation. But most of the time, what they're relying on is what they were told. So most of the time, they're not relying on their own observation. They're relying on their father's observation or their grandfather's observation or whatever, on a tradition that's handed down to them. Now, you know, we will see more of this next week in the book of Job. You know, what the fathers have always said must be true. And this comes from a very traditional society. Koheleth swims against the stream and wants to check everything out for himself. Now, checking everything out for yourself sets you up for a lot of surprise and a certain amount of disappointment. He says, I saw to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given beings to be busy with. What are we doing in this life, according to Koheleth? We're passing the time. We're not actually achieving anything. We may think we are, but no, he says, that's not the way it works. God is just giving us things to be busy with. And I saw all the deeds that are under the sun, and see, all is vanity and a chasing after wind. So he said, I said to myself, I have acquired great wisdom, and I applied myself to know wisdom and know madness and folly. And I perceive that this also is a chasing after wind. I don't think this has ever been prescribed reading for people applying to graduate school or even to college. You know, it's not actually the way you want people to think when they're starting in on a course of study, that this is all a chasing after wind. For in much wisdom there is much vexation, and those who increase knowledge increase sorrow. Now, this sounds awfully pessimistic, and we may want to talk a little bit at the end, you know, is life real? Are the prospects in life really so dreary? I think we will find as we go along, he may not be quite that negative. He does have an answer to it. But the key thing, you know, that drives him is there is no profit. There's nothing you take away with you at the end of it. Bear in mind now, of course, Koheleth does not believe in an afterlife. And we will see lots of discussion of that. This, I think, is one of the fundamental pillars of his worldview. You know, that there is no reliable reason to trust in an afterlife. This too, you know, is part of the canon of Christian scripture. The canon of Christian scripture is not a book of approved answers. It's rather a book of proposals, ventures that are put before you to make of them what you will. There, we can find other books in the Bible that will flatly contradict Koheleth on this. And at the end of this course, in fact, we'll have the Wisdom of Solomon, which is one of those books that very strongly argues for life after death. But this is the perspective of Koheleth. And think to yourselves, you know, does he have a point? Now, given the limits of the world we operate in, then I said to myself, come now, I will make a test of pleasure. Now, you know, this is a little bit funny, maybe. You can picture him. He is, you know, it's not just that he decides to go and enjoy himself because he wants to make a test of it. So if he goes out for an evening, his mind isn't turned off. He's observing himself. Am I actually gaining anything by this? And this perhaps is not the best way to do it. I searched with my mind how to cheer my body with wine, my mind still guiding me with wisdom. You may well feel that's his mistake. You know, that he just doesn't turn off his mind. But this is his mission. This is what he's setting out to do, is to observe. So is there, in fact, a profit to this? And he talks then about all the things that he has, all the possessions that he has, male and female slaves and so forth, great possessions, singers, men and women, delights of the flesh and many concubines, and I became great. Now, this is, if you like, a riff on Solomon. You know, he is speaking as if he were Solomon or a figure like Solomon. And whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. So I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can one do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. So in other words, what could he do and enjoy that Solomon hadn't enjoyed? And then I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. The wise have eyes in their head, but fools walk in darkness. Okay. So is there an advantage to wisdom? Well, yes, up to a point. But then I perceived the same fate befalls all of them. And this is the wall he keeps hitting up against. And so I said to myself, why then did I bother becoming so very wise? For there is no enduring remembrance of the wiser of fools, seeing that in the days to come, all will have been long forgotten. How can the wise die like the fools? And I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and a chasing after wind. Now, so, you know, again, he's frustrated. He sets out to gain something from all his searches, and he finds in the end, it's all dissipated. It all blows away. So his conclusion, and this is now towards the end of chapter 2 and verse 24 and following, and it's a conclusion that he will come back to. There is nothing better for mortals than to eat and drink and find enjoyment in their toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God, for apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy, but to the sinner he gives the work of gathering and helping, only to give to the one who pleases God. And then he stops and says, no, this also is vanity and a chasing after wind. Now, you see that there is a strong draw, a strong temptation, you know, to find an edifying conclusion. And I think that's what he's playing with here, is that he falls into, this is maybe where he suddenly becomes a preacher for a moment, and he falls into the cliche that to the one who pleases him, God gives wisdom and knowledge. And then he says, that doesn't actually work either. This too is vanity and chasing after wind. In other words, you know, there isn't, from his perspective, a meaning in life beyond the enjoyment you find in it in the present. That sounds a bit like the Epicureans. If any of you at any point read the Epic of Gilgamesh, you may be familiar with the same idea. You know, Gilgamesh famously went off, you know, his companion died. And so he went looking for the secret of eternal life. And in his travels, he encountered a barmaid who told him, Gilgamesh, where are you roving to? The life that you seek, you may not have. What you need to do is enjoy the wife of your bosom and hold on to the little one who holds on to your hand. For this is the lot of humankind. That's kind of the message of Gilgamesh, too. You can find parallels to this also in the Egyptian tradition. I think it's kind of common Near Eastern wisdom. But, you know, it's largely deflating the human aspirations to attain any kind of transcendence, to rise above the limitations of this life. Chapter 3, for everything there is a season. This is probably the most famous part of the Book of Koheleth. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to pluck. A time to kill and a time to heal. You know, I found myself thinking about this passage, listening to all the news about what's happening in Israel and Gaza and so forth. Wisdom, according to Koheleth, is knowing when it's the right time. My guess would be that Hamas didn't get it right. There are times to kill. Was this it? Now, no doubt some people would argue with that. But, you know, it is not the case that specific actions are totally off the table. It depends on being at the right time. There may be circumstances, well, they mightn't justify everything, but they would justify a lot of things. In this, too, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to embrace, a time to refrain from embracing, a time to tear down, a time to tear, a time to sow, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. Now, you know, that in a way is biblical ethics in a nutshell. If we were doing the Pentateuch or the Law of Moses, what we've typically do with the Law of Moses, the commandments, is you have two kinds of material in the Pentateuch. You know, you have the absolute laws, like the Ten Commandments, that sound absolutely, we call them apodictic laws, that sound like they have no exceptions. And then you turn over the page to the next chapter and you say, well, if so-and-so than something else. In the Ten Commandments, you read, thou shalt not kill. But in the next chapter, you read, but if somebody does certain things, you kill him. You know, the death penalty actually is prescribed for almost everything in the Hebrew Bible. Not incidentally for property crimes, but still it's applied to an awful lot of things. And it kind of makes a mockery of the idea that thou shalt not kill. And in fact, that commandment should have been translated, thou shalt not murder. The difference between murder and killing is murder is killing that is not permitted. Now, so does that tell you when it's permitted? Well, no. You've got to read on and find out all the different circumstances for that. But you see, this is the underpinning, you might say, of casuistic law, case law. And in this frame of things, you know, all sorts of things may be permitted, but the timing and the circumstances are crucial. That's why, you know, if you want to consider, say, what's going on in Israel at the moment, it isn't enough just to comment on the atrocity of it, and it is an atrocity. But you also have to look at the whole circumstances. You have to look at the whole context. And that has a bearing on it. Now, that may not automatically tell you what's right and what's wrong, but you can't arrive at a conclusion about what's right and what's wrong without taking the broader context into account. So this is the ethics of Koheleth. And at the end of it, he says it's a time for war and a time for peace. Now, you know, we often think, maybe Christians more than others, think, you know, about turning the other cheek, and there is no such thing as a time for war. But actually, there's also a strong Christian tradition about a just war. And that has a solid biblical basis. Now, again, I'm not saying you can't find biblical texts that would argue otherwise, but at least this is here. And then he says, what gain have the workers from their toil? Which comes, but brings him back again to his question, where's the profit? Where's the beef? You know, what do you take home at the end of the day? I have seen the business that God has given everybody to be busy with, he says. He has made everything suitable for its time. Moreover, he has put a sense, now, this is a tricky one. In the translation I'm reading here, which is the NRSV, it says, he has put a sense of past and future into their minds. The Hebrew word there is ha'olam. Ha'olam is the hidden, the old translation of this was, he has put a sense of eternity into people's mind. And I think, you know, in a way that got the spirit of it better than saying past and future, because what he's saying is that he has given people, you know, the sense that all of this ought to make sense. He has given people the sense that there should be a right answer to everything. But yet they cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. That there may be a meaning to it all, but that we can't know it. And that's what frustrates him. He said, I know there is nothing better than to be happy and enjoy themselves as long as they live. It's God's gift that all should eat and drink and take pleasure in all their toil. But whatever God does endures forever. That which is already has been, that which is to be already is. And God seeks out what is God by. In other words, God knows all of that. But in the end, what human beings are left with is resignation. Moreover, he says, I saw under the sun that in the place of justice, wickedness was there, and in the place of righteousness, wickedness was there as well. And I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked, for he has an appointed a time for every matter and every work. Now, that's a very typical biblical idea. Koheleth will come back, though, to say this too is vanity and chasing after wind. You know, don't count on it. You know, from Koheleth's point of view, we don't really know what's going on in life as a whole. And you just got to put up with that. I said in my heart with regard to human beings that God is testing them to show that they are but animals. Now, this is actually a sore point. And it's a point, I think, that's gotten a lot more attention in recent years. We always assume that the world is made for human beings, not for animals. But there is nowadays a growing movement of animal rights, which suggests that, you know, perhaps it isn't all just made for us. We'll touch on this again, actually, in the book of Job, you know, where God puts Job's troubles in perspective by talking about all the things that happen in nature that he has to worry about. Recently, we watched, I don't know if any of you have watched the program Yellowstone, and there's a prequel to it set in 1883, in which this young woman is, you know, discovering the West. And she expresses her amazement how God can make these beautiful flowers grow and then have poisonous snakes hiding under them. And says, how is that? And the commentator, the narrator in the series says, and then it hit me, he didn't make it for us. Now, mind you, that I thought was quite a remarkable insight to find in a television program. It's something that humanity as a whole has been very reluctant to allow as a possibility. But there, you know, if you think of the vastness of the universe, which the biblical authors didn't even know about, then you've got to allow that this isn't all just made for us. And so, says Koheleth, we're not so different from the animals. The fate of humans and the fate of animals is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. They all have the same breath. And humans have no advantage over the animals, for all is vanity. All go to one place, all are from dust, and all turn to dust again. That, incidentally, is probably the clearest biblical allusion in all of Koheleth. Now, there have been attempts at a predecessor at Yale named Brevard Childs, was very keen on something he called the canonical approach to biblical theology. And the canonical approach, you know, made everything cohere so that everything is assuming a kind of normative doctrine. And here, you know, the assumption would be that they all actually, you know, are alluding to the Torah of Moses all the time. Well, Koheleth isn't alluding to the Torah of Moses all the time, actually. He very, very seldom alludes to it, but apparently he didn't know it. And at least he knew the book of Genesis and this bit idea that people are all from dust and all turn to dust again, I think is straight out of Genesis. Fair enough. Who knows whether the human spirit goes upward and the spirit of animals goes downward to the earth? Now, that is one of the verses that gives us a clue as to when this book was written. For most of ancient Israel, the assumption was that when you die, you go down to Sheol. Sheol was like a damp basement, a gloomy place where you couldn't even praise the Lord. Beginning in probably the 3rd century, possibly early 2nd century BC, but probably the 3rd, you begin to get texts that conceive of the possibility that after death, some people, that there is a judgment, and that some righteous people are taken up to heaven, and other people go down to the netherworld to a place of punishment. In the Jewish tradition, you first find that in books attributed to Enoch. Enoch didn't make it into the canon except in Ethiopia, where the book of Enoch is regarded as prophecy. It was rediscovered about 200 years ago and has become quite popular in some circles in more recent times. But it was in that book, I think, that you first got the possibility mooted that righteous people do not just go to Sheol, that they're taken up to heaven to live with the angels. And that makes a little cameo appearance in the book of Daniel at the end of the Old Testament. And then that idea becomes very important for the New Testament. But, says Koheleth, who knows whether that is true? So I think this book must have been written when some of these ideas were already being kicked around and floated. But Koheleth wasn't buying it. We'll find that Ben Sira, whom we'll meet in 2 weeks' time, didn't buy that either. And he says that whether life is for 10 or 100 or 1,000 years, there is no inquiry about it after you die. Then the Wisdom of Solomon will take the diametrically opposite position on that. But this, I think, was actually much more typical of the ancient world. You know, in the Christian tradition, it is often assumed, you know, that the meaning of life depends on the judgment of the dead, of a meaningful afterlife. But people in ancient Israel and Judaism, even later Judaism, got along just fine without that idea. And that too is interesting, I think. But Koheleth isn't buying it at all. He says, who knows whether the spirit of a human goes up and the spirit of animals go down. So he says, I saw there is nothing better than that all should enjoy their work, for that is their lot. Who can bring them to see what will be after them? Now, by the time you get to the end of chapter 3, you have had the thought of Koheleth pretty well laid out. In the middle part of the book, he assembles a lot of, you know, proverbial wisdom sayings, the kind of things you would expect to hear from a wisdom teacher, and very often then comments on them, this too is vanity and chasing after wind. There are a few little gems scattered in and out between, and I'll just pick out a couple of verses here and there. In chapter 4, verse 9, two are better than one because they have a good reward for their toil. If they fall, one will lift the other up. As we get older, this becomes something we take more seriously. It is not good to be alone. So, you know, this isn't a kind of absolute value. It's a relative value. But, you know, it's better not to be alone. Again, says Koheleth, if two lie together, they keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? Now, if Christian sexual ethics had been based on Koheleth, there would have been a lot less hassle on a lot of things. We took a tour one time up in Deerfield, Massachusetts, of a historic village from the where they have houses preserved from the 19th century and earlier. And the guide alleged, at any rate, that at a certain point in history, especially widows, older single women, would actually go out and look for somebody to sleep with them. Not for sex, just to keep warm. They didn't have central heating in those days. Now, is it that, but this, I think, is kind of typical Bensira, typical Koheleth, and in fact, it's typical of the whole wisdom tradition. In the book of Proverbs, you had, don't go surety for another. You know, don't put up your belongings as a guarantee for somebody else. Why should your bed be taken from under you? You know, this tradition doesn't set much store by your intentions. It's concerned with what's the effect. And very pragmatic, in a very down-to-earth kind of way. In chapter 5, guard your steps when you go to the house of God. To listen is better than sacrifice offered by fools. Do not be rash with your mouth, nor let your heart be quick to utter a word before God, for God is in heaven and you are on earth. Dreams come with many cares, and a fool's voice with many words. You know, there's an awful lot of material in the Bible that is based on visions and dreams as a medium of revelation. And these things were generally thought to be a medium of revelation. For Koheleth, don't trust any of that stuff. Fulfill what you vow. It is better that you should not vow than that you should vow and not fulfill it. For God has no pleasure in fools. You know, if you offer something to God, you'd better keep it. You'd better do it. But it might be better to just keep your mouth shut and not put yourself in harm's way at all. A very nice statement in chapter 7, verse 16. Do not be too righteous and do not act too wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Is it possible to be too righteous? And I'm sure you all know what he means, what he's getting at here. You know, people who are too zealous, you know, who are pursuing the letter of the law or whatever, who lack a sense of moderation and reason. This, of course, is one of the cornerstones of wisdom in the Greek tradition. The Delphic Oracle said, nothing too much. Now, nothing too much applies to righteousness too. Can a person be too virtuous? Well, again, you know what he means. People who think they're virtuous. You know, people who try to put on a veneer of virtue. And Koheleth says, none of that. You know, do things in moderation, be reasonable. And a less attractive note, perhaps, you could see at the end of chapter 7. This is what I found, says Koheleth, adding one thing to another. One man among a thousand I found, and a woman among all these I haven't found. Now, there is it fair to call this misogynistic? I mean, this one isn't so bad. We'll have a more serious discussion of misogyny in this tradition when we get to Bensira. But you know, this is very much the literature produced by a male club. Men talking to men with a suspicion of women as outsiders, I think. Now, at least in the case of Koheleth, he's nearly as misanthropic as he is misogynistic, if that helps. But it is, you know, a kind of sour, dyspeptic attitude to things. In chapter 9, this is an evil that happens under the sun, where the fate, same fate comes to everyone. And then he's summing up, you know, what does, is one thing better than another? Whoever is joined with all the living has hope. For a living dog is better than a dead lion. The living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing at all. Even the memory of them is lost. Their love, their hate, their envy have already perished. Never again will they have any share in all that happens under the sun. So he says, go eat your bread with enjoyment and drink your wine with a merry heart. Let your garments be white. This is almost exactly like the advice given to Gilgamesh. You know, make the best of life while you have it. Whatever your hand finds to do, do with your might. For there is no work or thought or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol to which you are going. So make the best of it while you can. Now, I'll skip forward at this point. We're getting late towards the very end of the book. And chapter 11, verse 9, rejoice, young man, while you are young, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Follow the inclination of your heart and know that for all these things, God will bring you into judgment, which is maybe a significant caveat added to the advice to go enjoy yourself. In chapter 12, there is a quite moving allegory of old age. Remember your creator in the days of your youth. Before the days come when you say, I have no pleasure in them. And, you know, it's like a poem about old age, really. And it's kind of summing up what life comes to in the end. Vanity of vanities, says the teacher. Now, beginning in chapter 12, verse 9, you have a few sentences added that are not in the voice of Koheleth. So these are editorial comments, if you like. Besides being wise, the teacher also taught people weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs. The teacher sought to find pleasing words. Okay, this is the editor putting a little blurb on the book. The sayings of the wise are like goads, like nails firmly fixed, are the collected sayings that are given by one shepherd. And then it says in verse 12, of anything beyond these, my child, beware. Of making many books, there is no end, and much study is a weariness of the flesh. I think we're probably all old enough to testify to that. Right. But what I would say, point to underline in this, and this again is the editorial comment, of anything beyond these, my child, beware. You know, this is part of the canonical closure of the text. There was, as I say, a big debate about this book. Should this book be approved a scripture or should it not? And this is kind of the bottom line. Okay, you know, these are wise words. Why was this put in the canon? You know, my guess is that it was put in the canon because it rang true to people. That even though a lot of it may be stuff you might wish were otherwise, a lot of it rings true. And so, you know, it commanded assent and support, and it was not something that could be left out. But, says the editor, enough. Of anything beyond this, beware. So we'll accept this much. Don't think you can go on writing more stuff like this. In other words, it's an attempt to damage control, I would think. And then the end of the matter, fear God and keep his commandments, for that is the whole duty of everyone. I had a colleague at Yale who wrote a book arguing that that was actually the whole message of the Book of Koheleth. Fear God and keep the commandments. And that the rest was ironic. Now, if that isn't twisting the book, I don't know what is. You know, he is, this is what the editor says, like, you know, what the religious teacher says, well, you know, just fear God and keep the commandments and don't pay too much attention to this. But that's not the voice of Koheleth. The voice of Koheleth, as I read it, is question everything. Don't believe anything that you don't see reason to believe. And if that doesn't give you a whole lot to hope for, then make the most of what you've got. It is not, mind you, saying go out and have a great time and, you know, disregard law and morality or anything like that. That this would not be at all his approach to things. You got to be cautious. You keep your head down. You don't put yourself in the way of trouble. But at the same time, you don't set yourself up with illusory ideals that you would give your life for. You go with what you know, and you do the things that are within the range of your competence.
Thank you for joining us. Please join us next week for session 4.